Hi, everybody. Today is Thursday, April 10th, 2025, and our friend Pep Escobar is back with us. Welcome back, Pep.
Jesus, I don't even know where I am. Okay. So, Yemen, as always, salutes you, Nima, and our audience. I'm carrying Yemen with me everywhere. Gosh, I'm going to China, so I am in. This is my last day, and there's a lot of stuff to do before I go. So, right,
Pepe, we know that the United States and Iran are trying to. They're going to talk to negotiate, and before.
I don't think this thing in Oman is going to work, but anyway.
How did you find the, we know that Iran, Russia, and China had a meeting in Moscow on April 8th, 2 days ago.
Exactly.
What they were trying to coordinate, they were trying to negotiate or to talk on.
This is very, very important, Nima, because it's a sequence. It started, I would say, almost 2 weeks ago with a meeting in Beijing that was practically secret. It was very discreet. It was not publicized at all. There were no leaks. And I managed to get some information via diplomatic sources. This is when the trio, Russia, China, and Iran, and that's very important. I call them the new Primakov triangle. And we have to backtrack a little bit. The original Primakov triangle was Russia, India, and China in the late 90s. And this was coined by the late, great Yevgeny Primakov, foreign minister of Russia in the late 90s. Primakov was brilliant in terms of diplomat, international relations expert, and then foreign minister. He started as a journalist, by the way. He was a TASS correspondent in the Middle East. That's when he started. He was an absolutely outstanding politician, diplomat, and thinker. And this was the embryo of BRICS, the RIC, the original Primakov triangle. As Primakov conceptualized it, would be, let's say, the foundation for what would later would become the process of Eurasia integration. So we can say that to a certain extent, the conceptualizer of Eurasia integration already in the late 90s, when the Chinese were not thinking about it, much less the Indians, was Yevgeny Primakov. Now we have a completely different situation over a quarter of a century later. India is more or less, I would say, out of the picture in terms of a deciding power. They do remain a regional power in South Asia, but they are not a major pan-Eurasian power, not at all. Iran, on the other hand, now that Iran is a full BRICS member, and Iran deeply coordinates and connects with both Russia and China, they have strategic partnerships with both. And as you know very well, they signed a treaty late January in Moscow, signed by Presidents Putin and Pezeshkian, which is not a military alliance, but is a very important comprehensive partnership with the treaty. And in my latest column published earlier this week in the Cradle in Beirut, I draw the distinctions between these different strategic partnerships involving Russia, Iran, and China. The Chinese, a very Chinese way of thinking, they say that the relations with Russia nowadays, they are so extraordinary, so close, they don't even need a treaty. These are the words of Wang Yi himself, foreign minister. With Iran, it's It's more complicated because there was a trajectory of sometimes antagonism between Tehran and Moscow. And now, in this postmodern era, we can say that probably for the first time in the past decades, the convergence is practically 100% between Tehran and Moscow. And this is reflected by their official policies in terms of interacting with the rest of Asia. The official Iranian policy is called Look East. And the official Russian policy, not qualified like that, but boils down to pivoting to the East. So they're both looking East, but in terms of East, the enormous Eurasia East, right? And also includes a little bit of the West, because they are looking towards West Asia as well. They want to have good relations with very volatile neo-Ottoman Turkey under Erdogan. But basically, they look at Eurasia as a whole, like the Chinese. So the Greater Eurasia Partnership, which is the official geoeconomic, geopolitical Russian term for the integration, mirrors the Belt and Road Initiative, which is the overarching foreign policy framework for China in terms of Eurasia integration, geoeconomic and geopolitical. And this overlaps with the role of BRICS and with the role of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. So, any way you want to look at it, the three major actors of this matrix of official policies and multilateral organizations are Russia, China, and Iran. Obviously, Lima and all of you, our audience, this is virtually ignored in Washington. And when I mean Washington, I mean the whole Beltway, Virginia, Maryland, Washington. The absolute majority of the industrial, military, think tank, academia, media complex, and New York, and the connection New York, Atlanticist New York with Europe, and most people in the international financial system. So when you have these three actors and focusing on technical matters and at very expert level, directly related to the Iran nuclear deal. When they meet first in Beijing, these, let's say 2 weeks ago, and this past Tuesday, they meet again in Moscow. And this, 4 days before, and the announcement came when they were meeting in Moscow, in fact. If I'm not mistaken, the announcement came on Tuesday itself that Witkoff, representing the U.S., and Abbas Araghchi, foreign minister of Iran, would meet in Oman indirectly on Saturday. So we're going to have a very quirky situation of an American table in a room, a Iranian table in another room, and the Omani diplomats doing the back and forth because they're not going to speak face-to-face directly. So this points to you and to our audience how important it is. Practically two meetings in a row of the new Primakov triangle, the RIC, Russia, Iran, and China, major protagonists of Eurasia integration and of BRICS as well. And they have a concerted approach to solve a problem that in itself is not a problem. Don't forget that everything around the Iranian nuclear deal was, let's say, more or less solved by the 2015 deal that they struck in Vienna and later ratified by the UN Security Council. This is a very serious business. And all of you know who broke that deal. The current president of the United States. And now he wants to have his JCPOA 2.0, the Trump JCPOA, which is not a deal. Because according to everything that leaked so far, and we managed to confirm around Washington, is there are three imperatives that Trump passed directly to Witkoff. Witkoff is important because he has Trump's ear, and Trump passes ultra high class in terms of classified presidential information directly to Witkoff. He is his top envoy from the proxy war in Ukraine to the whole drama in West Asia. What Trump wants is essentially what the Zionist axis want and Netanyahu want. And obviously this did not leak Monday when they met in Washington, Trump and Bibi. But this is what Bibi and Trump agree on, because Trump is following basically Bibi's line on that. And Bibi later said, after their meeting in Washington, he said that they, the Israelis, want a Libyan scenario for Iran. And we know exactly what a Libyan scenario is. And we know exactly what happened after the Libyan scenario. Libya was destroyed, right? So there are three parts of, I would say the top three or absolutely absurd impositions that the Trump administration and Trump himself, what he wants to impose on Tehran. Number one, you have to destroy your civilian nuclear program. It doesn't get more absurd than that, right? Number two, you have to demilitarize. You have to destroy your very advanced missile program. And number three, you have to stop supporting the axis of resistance. Everybody, from Hezbollah to Ansarallah in Yemen and the Hashd al-Shaabi in Iraq. We all know the Iranian response to that, right, Nima? So that's why, I told you a few minutes ago that I don't place a lot of hope on what will transpire from these indirect negotiations in Oman, And Witkoff, don't forget, Witkoff is not a diplomat. Witkoff is not a Metternich or a Bismarck. He's a bloody real estate developer, come on. This guy doesn't know the nuances of diplomacy, and much less discussing a dossier so complex at that with professional diplomats, and especially Iranians, which are extremely competent diplomatically. So this is where we stand, Nima. It's extremely touchy. Maybe there will be a glimmer of hope. Maybe, who knows, maybe Witkoff will actually listen to Araghchi. And maybe Araghchi will be persuasive enough to explain the facts around the JCPOA, to explain the difference between JCPOA and Iranian national security, to explain that the United States has absolutely no business in interfering what Iran is doing, apart from specifically what was contained in the original JCPOA. And all of us who followed that at the time, 10 years ago, in Vienna especially. And I always repeat that when I was in Vienna following the last stretch of JCPOA, we're being briefed by the Iranians every day. And we even had a very long conversation with Zarif, over 2 hours, when he explained all the details of the negotiation to us. We were a small group of independents at the time. And at the time, he was already saying, look, it's enormous. The Americans want to include our missile program in the negotiations. And I told them, okay, if you want to do that, I'm leaving. Iran is leaving. We're not going to negotiate with you anymore. So the next day, Kerry was like, wow, because for Kerry, this would be a personal defeat. And at least the relationship between Kerry and Zarif at the time, there was mutual respect, at least. This is something that we could see by themselves. And it was confirmed by the Russians. Even Lavrov mentioned that at the time. Lavrov was there as well in the last minute negotiations. So now it's different. Now we start at the level of a real estate developer from New York. I wonder if you will understand how complex this dossier is, and how absolutely unrealistic and out of touch are these impositions by President Trump. So that's where we are at the moment, Nima.
You mentioned JCPOA. When you compare those days and today, how do you find the Iranian position?
Well, Iran has been saying over and over again, we are not against negotiations. We are against impositions, and we are against harassment, geopolitical harassment. But that's the Trump tactic. That Trump as the circus ringmaster, and everybody that knows how Trump operates, it's always like this. It's bombastic. It is a series of unilateral impositions, and maybe depending on his whims, and in fact that can change from one New York minute to another, literally, there are some sort of concessions, for instance. It's the same pattern all the time. The pattern of threatening and harassing Iran is the same pattern of threatening and harassing China with the tariff. It's exactly the same thing. Russia is different because Trump, at least he seems to understand that he cannot mess with a nuclear and hypersonic superpower. It's a completely different story. And personally, he actually respects Putin because Putin is very competent and very tough and a top-of-the-line negotiator. Trump cannot over-negotiate Vladimir Putin, but he thinks he can do that with everybody else, including Xi Jinping, and not to mention the Iranian leadership. But Ayatollah Khamenei is a very tough negotiator, and Ayatollah Khamenei is a man of principle. He never self-destroys in terms of burying his beliefs, his principles. And we are coming to a crucial juncture, coming back to what Ali Larijani said a few days ago, Nima. We talked about that already, no? That we don't want a nuclear weapon, but if we are forced and if we are facing an existential threat to Iran, we may have to do it. And obviously for that, the first fatwa from Ayatollah Khomeini and the second fatwa by Khamenei, which, if I'm not mistaken, I think is from the early 2000s, 2002, 2003, if I remember, Khamenei will have to revoke it. And obviously, citing an existential threat to the Iranian nation, which is what will be. If we have a hot war attack by the Zionist axis, US, Israel, this is an existential threat to Iran. And even our friend Mir Scheimer, this past week, I've been talking to John about an invitation to Iran, exactly. And John said in these past 24 hours that the only way to solve this problem is if Iran goes nuclear. And as you know, Jeremy Arsham is a realist, right? So that's why the whole thing is so immensely complex. And what we all fear is that Witkoff will not be up to the task. And obviously, there's an element of wishful thinking among all of us. Okay, maybe he'll start to understand the real facts of life, depending on how Araghchi explains them to Witkoff. So that's it. It's a very thin line, Nima, between total irrationality and a glimmer of rationality, which will have to be provided by Iran Saturday in Oman with the backing of Russia and China. And this is something that, for instance, Russian diplomatic channels, now that they are being reconstituted with the US, they can pass this to Trump or President Putin himself in the next phone call, which could last over 2 hours, like the last over 3 hours, whatever, like the last one, explain personally to Putin, look, are you willing to commit suicide for you, for your presidency, and for the United States? Keep going with the Zionist war.
The problem is that the people who are around Donald Trump are, they don't seem to be that much diplomatic, that much deep into the case of Ukraine or even with Iran. And if we look at the position of Russia and China and the nature of the relationship between Iran and these two countries, it has totally transformed so far. And it's something totally different from what it was during JCPOA.
Exactly.
On the other hand, with the interactions, direct interactions between Iran and Israel, and Iran has shown how they can hit any target in Israel. They don't mm-hmm. need nuclear weapons necessarily to confront Israel. As mm-hmm. you mentioned, nuclear weapons comes to the mind of Iranians when it comes to the United States and if the United States is going to attack them. These are, on the part of Iranians, they're thinking of all of this, as you've mentioned with the case of John Mearsheimer. But yes. how the United States is going to perceive all of that? Do you see that sort of expertise in the Trump's team? Witkoff, it's just, it seems that he has someone to talk in Ukraine, to talk with Iran. I don't know what's going on in his mind.
he's visibly unprepared, Nima. Come on. If we had a real diplomat, an American diplomat, conducting these negotiations, everybody would be a little more, you know, would be uplifting for all of us spectators, right? But that's not the case. For instance, among other things, I wonder if Araghchi will get to this point, but one of his key arguments is to explain to Witkoff, so he can explain to Trump, are you willing to go to war against three top BRICS at the same time, which have strategic partnerships among themselves and are supported by the bulk of the global South? Are you willing to be that isolated just to defend your Zionist masters? Are you willing to go against, in fact, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization as well, which is not a military alliance, but this will change the procedure of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. And if there is an attack like that, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization will solidify itself as a military alliance as well, which is not at the moment. Because other members will see, if they can do this to Iran, they can do to any one of us. And obviously, this is part of the war against the hybrid war, which could become hot, against Eurasia integration as a whole, against the Belt and Road Initiative, against China, now on a hot level, not only on a tariff level, because Iran is a very important geo-economic partner of China in the new Silk Road universe. A war against Russia as well, because of Russia and Iran, for the first time in the modern era, having a very, very close relationship. You know, coming back to 2 years ago, when there was an Iranian delegation in Moscow, 2 years ago, exactly 2 years ago, was March 2023. And I was asking them, and they said, look, was the best, the meeting was fantastic. We told the Russians, anything you want, you can get it. And the Russians basically told us same thing. And at the time, they were already starting to get closer on technical military aspects, using the terminology of President Putin. You know, so it's intertwined, and the fact that both Russia and China were instrumental to bring Iran to BRICS and to have Iran as a top BRICS member sitting at the table, not as a partner but as a full member, right? So all that, Nima, 99% of the Beltway, of the people in Washington and around, they have no clue about it. They don't even know what BRICS means. Ask them about the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. They have no idea what it is. You know, it's the usual frightening mix of arrogance, unlimited arrogance, and profound ignorance, which is reflected every time that Trump opens his mouth to talk about Iran, BRICS, ASEAN, he doesn't even know what ASEAN means, you name it. So that's what it's frightening. And it always comes back to the main point, and I would say the subjective element of this clash of the dwindling empire and the ascension of Eurasia as a whole, it's irrationality against rationality. These are three extremely rational actors: Moscow, Tehran, and Beijing. Well, I consider myself very privileged because I'll be doing a sort of informal BRICS tour, Nima, these past few days. I'm going to China first, then I'm going to Iran in the beginning of May, and at the end of May, I'll be back to Russia. So after this mini BRICS tour, we can have a pretty good idea on the ground of the RIC, the new Primakov triangle, not only how they're going to deal with this monster on the loose, which is the dwindling empire, but further on down the road, because in between we're going to have that, I would say this one is really groundbreaking. The second meeting between Putin and Xi around May 9, Victory Day parade in Moscow, where they're going to go deeper into that famous Xi to Putin at the end of their meeting 2 years ago. We are facing changes that we have not seen in 100 years. And guess who's in the driving seat? Russia and China. And guess who is the third one, not on the driving seat, but with, I would say, solid support by the two ones in the driving seat? It's Iran. So what does the empire have on the other side? The president of the United States being molded by a bunch of genocidal apocalyptical Zionists. From the point of view of the global South and the global majority, Nima, from the point of view of a Yemeni in a souk in Yemen, a Somali, somebody in Laos here, one of our neighbors in Southeast Asia, Bolivians, you know, they look at that and they see clearly the dichotomy, the option, and who are we with? Who do we support? And who we know that will support us as well? And what is the future in terms of international relations, especially now that in terms of the international trade situation, now it's beyond the chaos, right? Who can we trust? The Eurasia integration process, and obviously these two superpowers in the driving seat, Russia and China. And what they have to offer to the global South and the global majority in terms of a rational system of international relations, geopolitically, geoeconomically, trade issues, everything, is the absolute opposite of the dementia that is now emanating on, I would say, not even on a daily basis, but on an hourly basis from the circus ringmaster in Washington.
New York Times reported that they're concerned about the way that Donald Trump is moving the weapons from Pacific to the region to fight Yemenis. And I think the case of Yemen has contributed to what's going on between Iran and the United States. They learn how vulnerable are in case of if they want to confront Iran, because the case of Yemen that shows how Yemenis, they couldn't destroy the underground and nothing. Yemenis, yeah. That's why I believe they have decided to talk with Iranians.
That's a very good point, Nima. It's a very good point. Can you imagine Pentagon generals looking at their dwindling stock of missiles, where they are using billion-dollar missiles to fight $20,000 Yemeni drones, and they are losing, not to mention all the MK9 Reapers that they are losing now in sequence, And not to mention that who controls the Bab al-Mandeb and the Red Sea now? Still the Yemeni armed forces. Well, if he cannot, can you imagine them going against Iran? Wow, it would be a mega humiliation. And your point is spot on. This is one of the elements that is leading them at least. Okay, let's try some dialogue. But very, very important. Who suggested the indirect dialogue? Iran. This is not an American idea, right? Iran said, okay, we are open to negotiations, but they have to be indirect. And the Americans jumped at the opportunity because maybe they're saying, okay, this could be maybe a way out. But the problem is who controls the narrative and who controls the ultimate demential act, which is a war against Iran, because Netanyahu and the people around him, they see it as their ticket out of all the troubles they are in. And in their fantasy, of course, solidify Israel as the top power in West Asia, assuming that they can eliminate or neutralize Iran, which is the natural top power in West Asia. That's the problem. And Trump is caught in the middle of this dimension, right? Perhaps in the we don't know, because as we all know, Nima, he's not a thinker, he's not a strategist. His knowledge of the world at large is minimal. He doesn't know, he knows practically nothing of history and geography, not to mention how the system of international relations work. That's very, very dangerous. You know, we have a gigantic clown with an arsenal of nuclear bombs that he can access anytime he wants. That's extremely, extremely dangerous. It's as dangerous as the previous lodger in the White House, which was totally incapacitated, and basically the whole system was run by a bunch of freaks around him, from Sullivan to Blinken and everybody else, you know. It's as dangerous, if not more dangerous. And, well, for all of us who are, we were under the impression, at least, 3 months ago, 4 months ago, that, okay, maybe we're going to have a little bit of rationality in the White House, finally. Maybe we won't have forever, or at least a declining preference for forever wars. And it's getting worse, and it's getting worse all the time. He already started a war against Yemen, and he's considering a war against Iran. And he's talking about bombing Iran like somebody who goes to the grocery shop. That's extremely frightening. Extremely frightening. And there's nobody among Trump 2.0, nobody in the team, which are basically, you know, sycophants, you know, to, you know, have a 5-10 minute conversation about reality, or explain facts to him. First of all, because his attention span, Nima, as you know, in our audience, is a matter of seconds. If you cannot capture him with a catchy concept or sound bite in a matter of seconds, you know, he's already on something else. All that is very, very dangerous. So we rely on the power of persuasion of the rational actors, starting Friday with these negotiations in Oman.
Yeah, it seems Saturday, if I'm not mistaken.
It's Saturday, yeah. Saturday. Yes, yeah. We don't know if it's going to be the whole day, if it's going to go, you know, we still don't know. The only thing we know is that they'll be talking on Saturday. This could last 10 minutes, or it could last the whole day, or even go towards Sunday, hopefully, because then that's an indication that we'll be actually talking.
What was so positive about Witkoff in his interview with Tucker Carlson, that he had some sort of sense, he had some sort of attitude that shows us he wants to solve this problem in Ukraine or even with the case of Iran. But the problem, there is no foundation to build on. This is the problem. And Do you, with what has happened so far with the case of Ukraine, do you think they're going to be able, as long as they're negotiating with the Iranians, which we know they're totally, they're masters of this sort of negotiation. They were part, these people were part of the first team, the Zarif team in JCPOA. They know what they're talking about. But
yes, the part of they Donald Trump,
it's so much important that the two parties understand each other. And I would wonder if the Witkoff and his team are interested in learning more about the deep causes, the deep issues with the case of Iran. And do you see, is there anything positive with the case of Ukraine that would indicate that they're going to be able to communicate with Iran in a proper way?
Not really, Nima, because there is no evidence that Witkoff did at least the basic homework to understand the deepest reasons for the SMO, and especially everything that was happening since Maidan, from Maidan to the SMO. If you don't understand this period, you won't understand why there was an SMO, there is an SMO. All the evidence that we have is that Witkoff is absolutely clueless about it, not to mention before. And the whole drama, which is unrelenting NATO expansion, which he doesn't even touch upon in his public, as a public persona. So the precedents are not very helpful, right? These people are not pros, Nima. He's not a pro. He's not a pro in international relations. And this is one of the key issues in international relations of the 21st century. How to solve the non-issue of an Iranian nuclear military weaponized nuclear program, which is not. And it has been proven over and over again. The National Security Council of the United States, in their latest report, Iran is not building a nuclear weapon. These people usually, you know, and obviously they are all Iranophobes, but at least they have to bend to the facts. The problem is all this Zionist gang, it's never about facts. It's about messianic apocalyptic dementia, right? And of course, Netanyahu and those unspeakably disgusting people around him. For them, Iran is a bunch of Amaleks. In fact, everybody else is Amalek, right? So they have to be destroyed. It's absolutely horrible. And Trump, once again, because of his extremely limited historical, geographical, political, sociological background, he simply cannot understand that. None of that. And then he goes to the chain of command. If he doesn't understand it, his vassal, his sycophant Witkoff will, no, definitely not. And he's not talking to people in the US who could enlighten him about it. Do you see Witkoff talking, for instance, with our friends Mearsheimer, Ray McGovern, Larry, etc.? 10 minutes, any of them could explain the Iran, the whole Iran issue to Witkoff. Very simple. And they all have an intel background. Very, very important. No.
An important factor in Ukraine and with the case of Iran is China.
Yes.
We know how China supported Russia during the conflict in Ukraine. And do you think, when you look at the bigger picture, it's not just Iran, Russia against talking with the United States. The issue is China, as New York Times pointed out. They're just moving weapons from Pacific to the Middle East to fight the Yemenis, which the main enemy, the main competitor is China. China, do you think that China sees the same way, that what's going on with Iran, what's going on with Russia, is the first step against them, and they're going to be the next target? That's why there has to be some sort of mutual understanding between the parties involved, not just Russia and Iran, but China as well.
They know it's against them, Nima, absolutely. like, you know, coming back to the beginning of our conversation, if this war happens, it's a war against BRICS, and it's a war against three top BRICS, and it's a war against China, it's a war against the Belt and Road, against the New Silk Roads, against the Eurasian integration, against the Russia-China partnership, against the China-Iran partnership, against West Asia and the rest of Asia. The Chinese are. And next week, I'll be talking about this in China. This will be even more enlightening, right? This will be excellent to hear from them directly. And of course, the Chinese, of course, they are extremely discreet. They never announce what they're going to do. But in China, we can have a few glimpses of the way they are framing the dilemma and the possible tragedy ahead. Of course, they are prepared. We won't know until the last minute if there is an attack against Iran, how China will help Iran. There are many ways they can help Iran. Same thing with Russia. There is no military alliance. This treaty is not a military alliance. But Russia will not watch Iran being attacked by the Zionist axis, and Russia will be there just watching. Absolutely out of the question. There are a lot of extremely misinformed people peddling this notion. These people don't know how Iran works, don't know how the Russian leadership works, and don't know the enormous stakes in terms of the biggest issue of them all, which is this process of Eurasia integration. Includes all the multilateral organizations, include strategic partnerships, include geoeconomic investments in all that, includes, for instance, the International North-South Transportation Corridor, which is a big thing for Russia, for Iran, and for another BRIC, India, as well. So a war like that is also a war that will disrupt all these geoeconomic interactions. No question, because Iran is at the center of all these interactions. Iran is, we can, as a metaphor, and even if you look at the map, in terms of Eurasia integration as a whole, north, south, or east to west, Iran is the number one crossroads. So if you attack Iran, you disrupt the whole process of geoeconomic integration. Not only the Iranians know that very well, as you know, but Moscow and Beijing know that very, very well. And that once again explains why they had these two meetings focusing on technical aspects, first in Beijing and this week in Moscow, to coordinate their response or their counter moves to the avalanche coming from the other side.
China is the last one to join this direct confrontation, which I would say started with the conflict in Ukraine, Russia fighting the United States in Ukraine, Iran fighting the United States in Israel. Mm-hmm. And China just watching all of this, being trained in Ukraine. Their military has been trained in Ukraine, and they're learning a lot in Ukraine.
They're learning a lot. Yeah.
A lot to mm-hmm. confront us. And with the tariff war, it shows that how China is prepared to confront the United States. This is the first time that they're they're saying that they're going to go to the end to fight the United States.
It's very impressive, Nima. Especially for, you know, all of us who have been following Chinese foreign policy, this, let's say this past 30 years, since the handover in Hong Kong in 1997, this was the first step, according to Deng Xiaoping himself. Return of Hong Kong, and then 2 years later, 1999, the return of Macau. So, you know, their self-confidence was building very fast. They entered the WTO in the beginning of the new millennium. Then they become a trade superpower all over the world. And now they are sufficiently self-confident to say, we're not going to take harassment, intimidation, and threats anymore. And it's something that many of us saw this week, which is fascinating. the Ministry of Foreign Relations in Beijing resuscitating Mao Zedong tapes from the early 50s, with Mao saying, we're not going to back down, we're not going to, you know, nobody's going to force us to bend over. It's absolutely fascinating, you know, it is. And when China announced the counter tariffs against the U.S., the Chinese social media exploded with hundreds of millions of people following and supporting the Chinese counter move. So obviously, people who know nothing about China, like the Trump 2.0 advisors, like that imbecile Peter Navarro, obviously, you know, you don't have any one of them to tell their boss directly, look, this is not a good idea. You cannot antagonize not only the leadership in China, but the whole 1.4 billion Chinese, not to mention the very powerful Chinese diaspora everywhere. You know, this is a really silly move. There's nobody to tell him that, Nima, directly. And this is what he did. Now he antagonized the whole Chinese nation. Very bad move. You remember before the Hong Kong handover, I remember this very well. On the run-up to the handover in 1997, when Deng Xiaoping met Margaret Thatcher, which he used to qualify as that silly woman, and she was. And he told her, okay, we're going to get Hong Kong back. You know, it's stipulated. If you refuse, just wait. You know, the next day you're going to have 120 million Chinese disembarking in the UK. That kind of stuff, you know. So Deng at the time already, he was, don't mess with us and respect China. The only thing, the number one thing that the Chinese absolutely abhor is being disrespected, Nima. This is a cultural, it's the philosophical stone of Chinese culture, respect, which is a Confucian value. Respect for values, for the elders, for the people who know more than you, for teachers, for education, etc. And the way Trump is treating China now is with profound disrespect. Big mistake, which proves once again that his understanding of the finer points of cultural differences is less than zero.
Pepe, with the Biden administration, we've learned that they have lost the war in Ukraine. Even before Donald Trump.
The New York Times just found out, Nima. Did you know? Breaking news. The New York Times just found out that the Americans lost.
Yeah, because right now it's under Donald Trump. They can put the blame on. And we know how ineffectively Donald Trump was fighting Yemenis. They couldn't do anything. As CNN pointed out, $1 billion in a short period of time, and nothing came out of that sort of conflict with Yemen. China is just watching all of this.
Yes.
China is just, and look what Donald Trump is doing to the economic part of the conflict. It's just showing, exposing how weak the United States is, even when it comes to the economy. I think Donald Trump is doing is literally destroying everything.
Absolutely. It comes back to one of our favorite metaphors, many of us, that an auto-control pigeon destroying the chessboard, which is exactly what he's doing. And very, very important. I'm working on it probably for our next column. It was always about China, the whole tariff. Drama or reality show was never about the rest of the world. Although when we look at the first batch, the highest tariffs were against Asia as a whole. Our neighbors here in ASEAN, for instance, everybody in Asia and China. But in the end, it was the giveaway came from Team Trump 2.0 themselves. Besant himself, Secretary of the Treasury, he said his own words that Trump laid a trap to China. And they actually believe that they laid a trap to China. No, it's different. It was obvious, considering when the goddess of the market, to put it this way, taught Trump, okay, don't mess with me because I'm more powerful than you, and he had to backtrack. It was obvious that it was only about China, because the tariffs against China not only remained, he went up, and the Chinese counterpunch was almost 100% as well, and they're not going to back down. So the way he was being advised in terms of launching this tariff war, which in fact the destruction of the international trading system. Well, he just buried the WTO. Who's going to believe in the WTO from now on? And he buried the reputation of the US even more. It was already buried, but okay, a little deep down under, as a reliable, agreement-capable partner. So what Lavrov was saying during the time of the crash test dummy administration in Washington, that the U.S. is non-agreement capable, his own terminology, it's not only on a geopolitical level. Now it applies to a geoeconomic and trading level as well. So what's going to happen from now on? Even more integration of the global South, Eurasia integration, of course, Asia integration, different parts of Asia, and integration with Africa, Latin America, global majority, global South integrations. This will have repercussions on the BRICS summit in Rio in early July, if they are paying attention, and they are paying attention, most of the BRICS. De-dollarization will pick up speed. The digital renminbi is going to become a household almost everywhere across the global South, except the American vassals, because using the digital RMB, you escape SWIFT, essentially, right? So it's in terms of an own goal, this is something for the history books, absolutely. And there was not a single rational voice, once again, a rational actor in Trump 2.0 team to tell him, don't do this because it's going to be suicidal for your presidency and for the empire as a whole. And we already see that. And now that you fully antagonize the whole Chinese nation, oh shit, now we're talking about a really bad move, you know. And China won't back down. They don't have to. For instance, I was reading Guan Cha today. And most of the articles in Guancha, they're excellent, and they're scathing, you know, they're destroying the stupidity of the president of the United States and reiterating that China, ASEAN, and China collaborating with ASEAN and with other partners in the global South, they don't need the American market. And so you're going to have iPhones for $30,000 if you manage to fabricate them in the US. It's going to take, apparently it took Apple 4 years to delocalize to India, part of the production to India. So it's going to take Apple another 4 or 8 years or whatever to de-delocalize from China back to the US, assuming that would happen, to make iPhones costing at least $3,000, $5,000, $10,000 or whatever. Who's going to buy that? It's absolutely ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous. But it's frightening. Because it happens because you have a circus ringmaster out of control without a single rational voice to tell him what you're doing is beyond absurd. Please reconsider. It's impossible, Nima. He doesn't listen to anybody.
What's so scary for Donald Trump, in my opinion, is that China is reacting out of confidence, not out of being fearful of the United States. That's the scary part. They know what they are. They know what they're seeking for. They know how to get their energy. And the United States doesn't seem that much smart. Unbelievable.
No,
This is Nima, surprising.
They don't know all the weapons, all the economic financial weapons that that China may deploy. Not to mention China united with the majority of the global South. This is about China and the global South as a whole. This is a war against the global majority. So, you know, specifically, if there is an attack against Iran, it's a war against BRICS and a war against Eurasia integration. The tariff war is a war against almost the whole global majority. You just look at the list, right? Including those penguins, you know. So it's absolutely crazy. You see a dwindling empire, an empire that is up against a wall with practically no way out, lashing around like crazy, irrationally, at random, without direction, literally, and without a project or a major idea into guiding the reaction or where you want to go or offering anything positive to the rest of the world. Nothing. We just see a monster on the loose, literally, you know. No wonder. And this is being seen all over the global South, the global majority, not only China, the rest of the global South. Some countries, of course, they are much more vulnerable because a lot of their exports go to the American market. So they need some sort of composition. But this is out of necessity. It's not because they actually believe in it. And they know that this could be maybe a partial maneuver. And later on, they will deepen their integration with these big global South markets, especially China, India, Iran, Russia, you know, big powers of Eurasia integration. And the US has absolutely nothing to offer to the global majority except pay more taxes, more tariffs and more taxes to me, keep feeding my bloated economy while I keep printing this green things that are worth absolutely nothing. I keep ballooning my deficit. It's not going to change much, you know. So it's the danger element of all that is that the monster on the loose is totally out of control. And it will get even more dangerous from now on, literally. So all of us, we have reasons to be extremely wary.
Pepe, just to wrap up this session, with all you've said so far, do you think that Donald Trump is losing his opportunity to improve the position of dollar, or he has already missed the opportunity?
I think he already missed it, because dismantling the international trading system without offering anything to replace it, it's beyond deaf, dumb, and blind. To remember the who, the deaf, dumb, and blind kid, show knows to play pinball, and he doesn't even know how to play pinball. That's even worse, you know. So this will accelerate de-dollarization. This will accelerate alternative settlement systems in their own currencies everywhere, all across the global South. This will accelerate the geoeconomic vectors inside BRICS deliberations. This will speed up something that we, last year during the BRICS summit in Kazan in October last year, we could see that, okay, maybe this is the beginning of the high-speed rail train is leaving the station now from Kazan. So now the high-speed rail train is already picking up a lot of speed. It's like that maglev train that you take when you arrive in China in Pudong Airport to get to the center of Shanghai, you know. That we're getting to maglev speed levels soon in terms of de-dollarization, alternative payment systems, the role of the digital renminbi, escaping from SWIFT, all the the mechanisms that have been tested in what I call last year the BRICS lab in geoeconomic and financial terms, it will accelerate it because the global majority and the global South will see that we simply cannot trust this mega partner anymore. He's becoming a danger to all of us, not only to some of us. So we have to carve our way out of the system that they implemented, imposed, and controlled until recently. Not anymore. So the high-speed rail train is already reaching full speed, Nima, and the sooner, the better.
Yeah. Muito obrigado, Pepe.
Obrigado a você, querido. Obrigado.
Prazer, como sempre.
Enorme prazer. E, okay, next week, I don't know. Next week, I'm going to have a crazy schedule in China. But and then after I'm going to Hong Kong, we can speak from Hong Kong. This will be fantastic as well.
Yeah, for sure.
Cheers. Obrigado. Até mais. Tchau, tchau. Bye-bye. Okay.